That's all right. I'm sure you were just surprised as to how early I was.
Yep. Well, it's nice to see that I won't be doing this solo.
I have all the faith in the world that you can do this solo.
Yeah, it would be a very short show. Excuse me, gentlemen. Our usual host hasn't shown up. Our next posting date will be. came across a bit of weird open source software.
Oh yeah, what was it?
MVS 3.8J.
Go on.
This is an 80s era MVS 24-bit. That is to say, maximum configuration is 16 megabytes. There's a version called TK4, which has a whole bunch of stuff built into it. It's designed to run on the Hercules emulator.
So what does it do exactly?
What it runs is a early version of IBM's commercial operating system for 370s, the virtual memory version of OS 360. Or rather, its follow-on.
You have any plans of things you can do with that?
Well, you get to learn all the IBM languages and stuff. Also, the next version is going to have built-in TCP/IP support. Right now, you have to use a 3270 terminal emulator.
Have you tried it out yet?
I haven't tried it out. I may wait for the TCP/IP supporting version. There's supposed to be a 9th update pack coming out sometime this year. It supports IBM-based networking between systems, even a cluster computing model.
That sounds interesting. I'm not sure I'd have any use for it, but it definitely sounds interesting.
No, I got some other stuff to get up. I'm looking to do a Ubuntu, but it appears that Ubuntu, with its Snap and Flatpak support, is going to be better suited to my larger machine.
By the way Ubuntu is going, I think it's going to be always be better suited for a larger machine. That goes back to my whole 32-bit bias.
Well, I've got a you know, that single core 64, but I'll probably have to put Sparky, which is Debian, on it because I won't have the overhead to do large. I won't, you know, to do the static linked packages.
Good evening, Joe. Welcome.
Hey, guys. What's going on?
Not much. How we doing?
Just chilling at the house, enjoying a nice long weekend.
Nice.
Figured I'd come and see how you guys do things over here.
Generally, we do things very slowly over here.
I don't think we have nearly as much fun as they do over at Tilts, but it's a good time.
Yeah, I hear we cuss a lot over there.
I heard that.
I'll try to keep it down to a minimum today.
Well, we appreciate it. So do you do a lot of networking for a living?
No, I do a lot of networking on my own. Mostly I'm production support.
Production,
what type? I work for a bank, so it's mostly international money market stuff. I watch a lot of batches.
Let's say, what would be involved with the production side? Do you do any programming, or is it mostly just maintaining? I don't even know where that would go.
Well, as production support, I'm not allowed to write any of the programs. You know, the whole development cycle, the programmers are supposed to write the programs, and then the production support guys are supposed to push it out and watch it.
Okay, so what's involved with watching it?
Mostly, how do I explain it? Mostly if something happens, if I get informed of something, or if I see that a batch has failed, then I start troubleshooting. I can perform fixes if it's a known error. If it's not a known error, I need to contact a developer, and then we will go through and they'll say, okay, this is what needs doing, and I'll do it. We do some of our own Python scripting, but mostly that's for metrics.
That sounds like a pretty good gig.
Now, what operating system are you working ZOS?
We work across a lot of different systems. I mean, until recently, there was a few Solaris systems. There were still Linux systems. There's Windows galore.
You said you were going to keep down the foul language.
Yeah, sorry about that one, but it is something that I work with on a daily basis.
I'm just teasing, but... Yeah, I'm kind of glad that I'm off the Windows treadmill. The Linux treadmill is kinder and gentler.
Yeah, I've moved as far away from Windows in my personal life as I can. There was a time where I was really grateful to Windows for their automatic updating when I was doing repair work for in-home. And got a lot of calls. Hey, this update bricked my system. Come fix it for me. When they were moving from 8 to 10 for free.
Oh, I've heard a lot of horror stories about that.
Yeah, I hear horror stories. My brother is a long-haul trucker, and he's running 10 on a laptop, and... He says all of his stuff is cellular internet or Wi-Fi. And when Microsoft decides to do a patch, his system basically goes out to lunch.
Yeah, I heard a story about a girl who was in college, I think, and she had an 8 machine and kept on wanting to do the update from 8 to 10. She kept on telling it no, and she was in the middle of doing something and wasn't able to tell it no fast enough, and the thing just started like right in the middle while she was in the middle of class.
Yeah, did you hear that the next version of Office is going to be a 10-only system?
Yeah, but this is from the internet, so any system.
Yeah, somehow I wouldn't like to do my accounting on 360 on random server somewhere.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm hearing good things about LibreOffice 6.
Now, Joe, have you ever tried OwnCloud or NextCloud?
Yeah, early on with OwnCloud, I was using it.
Let's say, ask if you had any experience with their attempt at trying to do a Google Drive stuff, but it's the Google Office type stuff.
No, I haven't tried any of that. I know that. Was it LibreOffice that was trying to work with Dropbox to make your stuff accessible from anywhere and easily usable?
Actually, I think they work with Google Drive.
Okay. No, I haven't tried any of those. The closest thing that I use really is Simple Note, and that's just for notes everywhere.
I'm thinking of putting up something like Nextcloud. I've got an old e-machine server that I may make my server.
Have you looked at BT Sync?
No, I haven't. That's yeah, I'll have to think about that. What that used to have a different name, didn't it?
BitTorrent Sync, and then they changed it to BT Sync, and I think now it's just called Sync. Or, well, oh, they had another name for it too. Let me look that up real quick. Rosilio Sync.
Now, are they still a pay service?
They do have a paid tier, but the free tier works just fine for me. I haven't found any limitations on that.
Wasn't that the big problem when BitTorrent Sync first came out? Is everyone jumped on it, and the guys who developed it all of a sudden decided to shut everybody out and make it a paid service?
Yes, that is exactly what happened. I quit using it for like a year, year and a half after they did that, because they just really messed up the free service that they had, and then they found out that they were losing their customer base that way and started adding features back into the free version, and I started using it again.
That might be something to look into there, Netminer. I've heard nothing but good things, well, at least when BitTorrent Sync first came out. I mean, everybody I know was jumping on that.
The setup is a lot easier than OwnCloud used to be.
Now, can you keep this internal?
Can you say that again, please?
I'm looking for a solution that runs inside a domestic firewall.
Yes, it can sync locally. It does not have to go out and then come back.
One thing I did like about OwnCloud and NextCloud was the web interface for it.
Yeah, I don't remember the web interface for OwnCloud, but the one for BT Sync works well enough. I mean, it's not really feature heavy when you look at it, but it is useful.
Now, what do you have BT Sync running on?
Well, I have it on at least two Linux Mint machines, and I do have it on my one Windows machine, and I also have it on my phone.
Now, is it a peer-to-peer type thing, or is it you have one set up as one set up as a server?
I have them all with permissions. You can limit the permissions based on which ones. You can just put out the reads on that and have one of them act as the server, but all of mine are acting as servers and distributing everything to all of them. The more nodes I have set up with BT Sync, the faster anything will sync.
So basically it's you set up a folder that's your BT Sync folder. And then once you install it on different things, you send the key over to you get BT Sync installed, and you basically send the key over to one of the other machines, or you set up that key in that machine, and it automatically starts syncing between the other machines?
That is correct. You get the key off the first machine, send it to the second machine. They have a couple of different ways they do the keys, either with just, I think, a 16-character code or an actual web link that will link to your folder, and then you tell it where and it starts syncing automatically. But you can tell it to only sync the files that you want synced.
Okay, I'm slowly remembering how BitTorrent Sync worked. It's 9:22. I might have to poke 5150, make sure he's awake.
Joe, your audio's been breaking up.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, you may be overdriving something.
I'm using my phone. I'll switch headsets here in a second and see if that helps.
Yeah, I'm going to have to get a an amplified USB audio system for one of my machines, at least one of them. I'm running into problems with the YouTube Dynamics.
Is that better, Netminer?
That sounds much better.
Oh, I have my mic open.
Switch to my Sennheisers.
All right, so 50 said he'll be here in about 15 minutes. Yeah, I remember there was a time when people wanted to distribute podcasts that way, where they would set up a folder and then give out the key to distribute a podcast. Well, they wanted to do something along those lines, whether it was podcast distribution or it was podcast distribution. But either way, there's a lot of people who had a lot of ideas of what they wanted to do with BT Sync before they went to their paid model.
Yeah, there was a lot more interest in it back then.
So, Joe, do you play with any single board computers?
Oh, you know, I got a couple of Raspberry Pis floating around.
Wait.
Used to have a lot more time to work with them. I mean, back before the Ring video doorbell came out, I was making my own system to basically take a picture and email it to me whenever the motion sensor went off. I've tried the whole setting them up as desktop things and still haven't found any that are powerful enough. I used to
do the MAME systems. Had a lot of fun with those. For a while, when Intel was offering $50 a project, I was doing the Intel Edison, which was interesting, since it came with a couple of different hats that you could hook up to it. And then I think one of the projects we made was a learning system for Morse code. You could basically type anything in over SSH and it would beep it out one letter at a time for you. And then we made a doorbell with it. And I did figure out a way to set up BT sync on that using a USB stick. And then mostly, well, I tried setting up Plex on there, but I didn't want to the transcoding was an issue with it, and I didn't want to finish it up the right way and change the coding of all the videos.
Yeah, there's one octa-core out there that looks interesting. And there are a number of single core x86 based single boards that look very interesting.
Yeah, but it seems like a lot of the x86 development is going away.
Well, what they're doing with a lot of it is that they've gone to Celerons and Pentiums on even on the single boards, so you get a 2, 4, or 8 gig. Basically, you're running basically your laptop CPU. I know one of the UDOs has two display ports and a HDMI output, so they're getting serious with the video. One of the most interesting hardware hacks I've seen was somebody running a video card off of an x86 single board.
How did they hook it up?
Well, some of the single board x86s have many PCI slots. There's an adapter you can get that gets your mini PCI to a PCI X1, and he drove this large video card using just one channel. It's not what you'd call efficient, but he was able to run Grand Theft Auto and stuff on a ridiculously small single board machine. Now, if you got an X1, a true X1 video card, you probably wouldn't get that performance, but you'd probably get pretty good for media and stuff.
So I put in the mumble chat this beast of a single this beast of a single board computer that I found the other day.
That is beastly.
Socketed CPU?
Yeah, it looks like it. I'm afraid to see the price tag on that.
Request an estimate.
This is a bit of a Barbie doll with no clothes. Power supply, CPU, and case. And where's the memory hidden?
The two slots right there, next to the processor. This is up to 32 gigs DDR4, so you just get some DDR4 sticks, plug them in.
God, that makes my two first generation APUs look like netbooks.
I know, right?
I mean, these are full towers with 16 gigs of whatever they would drive, 1333, DDR2. DDR3, whatever. I even have a processor for that beast.
Yeah? You got a skylight kicking around?
I don't know if it's a skylake, but somebody was building on a mini ATX system a i7-6700T processor. I don't know if it'll be compatible with this. It's an 1151 chipset, socket set. Watt CPU.
Now, I wonder what the 8x stackable expansion is. Four times SATA or four times USB 3. I mean, what makes them stackable?
Well, I think, if anything, it's got to be stacked underneath. Yeah, it's got to be built like a PC 104 system.
Okay.
The reason I say it has to be underneath is there's no, I mean, you put a heatsink or a cooler on this beast and the top side's pretty much lunged.
That is true.
It's already got NAS written all over it.
I don't know, four gigabit Ethernet ports? Firewall.
Well, yes, put an i3 one in as your firewall and another one in as your NAS/VM support.
I almost just think that something that's just straight up Raspberry Pi size, just with like either 2 to 4, you know, 4 or 5 USB, not USB, gigabit Ethernet port, or just Ethernet ports for that matter, would make a perfect firewall. This thing is just a beast. I mean, there's so much potential there with so many things that you can use it for, that almost that like using it for a firewall would just seem to be like not using it to its full potential, you know?
Well, I could see them to use this to its full potential, I would say you need it probably 2. And one of them to run your VMs and the other one to run the storage, and bond the gigabit link.
How do I sound?
A little low, but okay.
Well, that's fixable. I'm just on a different headset tonight. I finally got around to fixing the wireless headset.
Nice. What'd you wind up using?
I got Suguru. And you're right, probably about, you know, except the fact that I have Suguru left, I probably could have got another set of headphones for about the same money, but I always liked these when they worked. How about now?
Perfect.
Sounds pretty good. I always enjoy fixing the LG HPS models.
Sorry about being late. I knew, well, I had some stuff happen in town that delayed me, but I thought it was going to be more like 15 minutes late, not 35 or 40.
That's fine.
You are about 15 minutes late.
Good point.
Yeah, a real world starting time and 9 o'clock have very little income. Just like the doctor appointment thing, most of my doctor's appointments, at least with MDs, I add 15 minutes. I get there on time, but I know that there's going to be a 15-minute wait state.
Yeah, I was going to say, you may have to, you know, you're not going to be going in there 15 and on time, but you got to show up on time.
Yeah. One clinic I go to has a $20 surcharge if you're late, and I said, well, all right, if my doctor's late, do I get $20? They said it doesn't work that way.
I was going to say, did you get the laugh or the stare down?
Yeah, my GP is usually pretty good about that. It's the, but of course, it's, you don't see him first. You see the nurse or the specialist or the practitioner rather or whatever. Then he comes in after. But your specialist, yeah, they, surgeons or whatever, they're never on time.
Well, I changed my primary from the doctor to the physician's assistant, and my care went up in standard considerably.
Well, the doctors, they count their time as pretty precious. The PAs could spend a little more time in the room with you.
Also, for what I usually get, I I get, I'm not going in for the specialty of the of this physician, and normally I get maintenance on a couple of health issues, general health and something specific, and the PA is fully competent to handle that. Let's face it, a PA is at least medically competent as the general practitioner of some time ago.
Hey, as long as they don't bring leeches, I'm comfortable.
Good bloodletting is good for you.
Yes, but you didn't say whose.
Fair enough.
Yeah, well, I have a neighbor I believe leeches will turn up their nose at. No. Just like why sharks don't bite lawyers, professional courtesy.
Exactly.
I did get a nice Valentine from my neighbor, though. He put the barbed wire on the top of his chain link fence. That took away half my driveway.
Well, that's when you know you're welcome.
What's he going to do for Easter? Electrify it?
I don't know, but I'm wondering which stadium I should rent when I, for the alternative wake for him.
That many friends, huh?
There will be that many people who will celebrate his passing more than they do his life. From what I've heard from a reasonable sample size.
All right, so who wants to do the hosting?
I was going to volunteer, but I vote Joe.
Nah.
No, I think you did it last time, Honky, so I guess it's my turn.
All right.
Sorry, seems like my control key's a little wonky.
Joe, I'm the official Indian here. These other two are the chiefs.
Does that make me the invading white man?
No, you're just the guest. And
calling us chiefs would imply we knew anything about what we were doing.
Not necessarily. Certainly, enough of us have had management experience with management who, well, might have trouble leading sailors to a bar.
Yeah, I understand exactly what you mean. Did we have any feedback? I don't particularly remember any.
No.
Okay, well, I'm ready to start reading if you guys are. All right, welcome to Linux Lugcast. We are an open podcast slash lug that meets at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time every first and third Friday of the month using Mumble. If you would like to join us, please visit linuxlugcast.com for the server details. We also have a Mumble how-to on the site explaining how to configure Mumble. Then just join us in the Linux Lugcast room. During the live show, if you are unable to join us in Mumble, you can still listen to the live stream. You can also join us in IRC on Freenode, channel hash Linux Lugcast. If you have any questions, comments, or topics you would like us to discuss, please email us at feedback@linuxlugcast.com. We also have a Google Plus community site and a mailing list. Visit our website for the direct links. Evening. This is 5150, your host for this evening. This is Linux Lugcast episode 97, which reminds me I need to get on something organizing for show 100. That's just going to be in just over a month. All right. Also on the channel with me are Honky Magoo.
Evening.
And Joe.
Hello.
And last but certainly not least, Netminer.
Hello, folks.
Okay, seeing that there is no feedback, at least we can remember if somebody did write in or put something on the Google Plus and we missed it, we apologize. Catch up with next month. So, unlike the last few weeks, I actually did some real-world projects. Of course, all of this was very late. Well, not late, but yesterday, so I don't have a whole lot to brag about. But we've been talking the last few weeks about the various home assistant devices that are out there, and you know I call them valid because I think at some point, probably I am guessing even the ones that are packaged up and sent out by companies are running something based on Linux is going to be my guess. Google Home, I always thought that was probably Android, though we do know coming out in a couple years, Google has announced they're going to move from Android to a proprietary system on phones that they can control. So who knows? Maybe that's actually early version of that and I'm completely wrong, but we are integrating these into our computer systems, including Linux, into our networks, so fair game. The one I'm going to talk about this evening is my Mycroft Mark I. If you heard last week's discussion, I think the week before, they've gotten fully funded on the Mark Two, which really, I don't know if it's going to perform a whole lot better as far as speed, but it's fixing all the hardware problems that they learned with the Mark One, that made it into production, and then they saw, yeah, we're getting complaints about this and that not being so good. On that, I think it was Jay Rulo commented, said when I put on G Plus. Yeah, I know, but I backed the Mark II anyway. It's way too much for what you're getting, especially considering the other options. Like I got Google Home on Black Friday, the mini one for 15, no, 25. Even so, you know, four times, you know, I think more than four times as much for the Mark II. And they haven't said what's based on yet, but I bet it's still just going to be a Pi 3. And here I'm just rambling stuff we've covered before. But, Jay Rulo's comment. The Mark One, the microphones were very poorly designed. If you had anything else going on in the room, it couldn't understand you if there's a TV on or a radio on. And really, I'd be really impressed if anything could understand me over the TV or the radio. I really don't think the Google Home Minis do a very good job of it. However, I guess that's why they're cheaper. You get the whole full size thing or the Echo, the whole full price $200 package probably does a lot better job with speakers than the little $25 Echo Spot or whatever it is, or the equivalent Home Mini. So, you know, since it has a reputation for not being able to understand you very well in a noisy environment, I thought, well, what's one room that I'm probably, when I use it, I'm not going to have anything else turned on? And, you know, I decided the bedroom. So I set it up on my night table. And you can unlike all these other devices, since it is essentially just a Raspberry Pi 3, you can SSH into it just like any other computer. Within reason, because there's going to be some storage issues and whatever, you can install about anything on it that you wanted. Just like a regular Pi 3. I mean, if you wanted to make, I mean, you probably want to add some storage or something to it. You do have four USB ports in the back. You could technically take it apart, take the image off the card, or copy the image to a bigger SD card, put it back in, get more storage that way. So, you know, technically, if you didn't have anything else to use as a server, you could maybe make this a Mattermost server or something like that. excuse me. And probably not affecting the other, you know, the Home Assistant functions. So, first, SSH is not enabled by default. So the first step on top, there is a dial switch. It's a rotating switch, and then you can press down on it. And you've probably seen things like this on some of your old printers and stuff to set up functions. Menus have gotten better now, but I mean, if you've ever set up like IP address on a printer 10, 15 years ago, this will not be so foreign to you. So, the Mark One, the packaged Mycroft SSH is disabled by default. Now, by contrast, if you're building your own, if you just got a Raspberry Pi and you downloaded the image and you did your own speakers and microphone and all that, put together your whole thing just using their software, that's called a Pycroft. And on those, they do assume you're going to have to get into it remotely to set things up. So SSH is enabled by default, but not on the consumer Mycroft. So you got to get fiddly with that rotary dial and pushing up and down. And that's not, you can change things like brightness and stuff with it. In fact, that's the first thing it gets to, being in the bedroom and not want the thing fully bright with all the LEDs on the front all night long. So I turned that down to just about zero. But enable SSH. You can ask Mycroft, what is your IP address? And it'll display that on, well, it'll say it also, of course, but it'll display it on the scrolling past on the front dis left to right on the front display. So that's a way. Though, let's see here. Moving stuff around on the screen just a minute. There is actually a name for the Pi, so that you don't have to have that. I mean, so you could, I think you SSH into mark one dot lo mark underscore one dot local. I'm pretty sure that's in the documentation. I'm probably add that to the what I've got here on the show notes before the end of the show. So you enable SSH. That took me a while as I kept getting rejected. Well, it's because it talked, their documentation could be a lot better. I'll have to say that because I had to jump from one place to another place because it said, yeah, you can set up all this stuff. And I guess the first thing I wanted to do, which we'll get to, the Mycroft comes with a set of skills, some things it can do. And then there, in the months that it has been out and out in prototype, I mean, people, the people who got the early prototypes have had them for over a year. So there's been various what they call skills or other functions that have been user created and added. And you have to install those manually. So that would be one reason you'd want SSH into it, because that's how you need command line access to do that. So lost my train of thought here. So got it working with SSH. Then of course it's got various, I didn't put in the show notes, it's easy to find the for SSH, the user is Pi, and the password is Mycroft. And they are suggesting, that's if you're gonna enable SSH, that's the first thing you do is change that default user password. And I wanted to go further, because every machine here on the network, I'm using pretty much the same login, the same password, when I to remote log in. And the username is my given name, the one that's on the on my birth certificate. So I didn't want to just change the password on the Pi account. I wanted to create an account with my name. So this is one of the first things I did after getting SSH access, and this is essentially what I do with, any headless device that I build, because there's going to be a default username and password associated with just about any image. And of course, you don't want to, just like the Pi or the Mycroft, you don't want to leave that default password that's out there on the internet. And like I said, I prefer to, just create a new account with my name on it, because if you if you change the username, then in the home, under slash home, it's still going to be Pi. So, or whatever the default was, rather than what you changed it to. So, you know, I would just rather start off with a fresh account. But one of the things you want to watch there is that that account has all the same privileges as the default account, and there's no one Linux command to do that for you. You know, say, you know, there's no clone account command. I was looking around. There are several, you know, scripts that you can copy, but looking at them and the way they did things, well, I tried one and I think it left out, you know, creating a directory. So, well, so I guess it said that target user isn't there, so to create a target user, I just said, nope, we'll start over and use a couple commands. So, and I've got them here in the show notes. And like I said, this is something not specific to the Mycroft. This is setting up, you know, personalizing any headless device that you down, you know, you download an image, and first thing you want to do is change the security on it. So, and all these are going to be elevated. So I put the sudo in. A lot of times you'll see on documentation, they, you know, they leave that, leave it out and assume you know that you need to go elevated, either use sudo and elevate yourself to root before you do anything, or add sudo to the front of everything. I just thought it's a lot more readable just to put it in this way. And if you're not using a distribution that recognizes, you know, uses sudo by default, I assume most people listening to this are have enough experience with Linux that, yeah, they know they have to get elevated some other way. So, to find out what groups that default user it is attached to or is a member of, sudo space id space, and then of course the username. And I, in the show notes, I put in pi because that, you know, being specific to the Mycroft. And, you know, it'll show you other stuff like the UUID, but it'll show, you know, it'll show that, and then this group and this, you know, be prefaced by a group and then a name and another name and another, you know, group and another name. Okay, so the way you create an equivalent user, sudo space user add space dash lowercase m space dash uppercase G space, and then all those group names separated by commas. You know, everything you had from before, that comma, next group, comma, next group, and then at the end of it, you know, after you put in all the group space, and then the name of the new user you want to create. And of course, the last step is creating a password for that new user. So sudo space password space new username. Well, let me explain. I skipped over. Let me explain those flags on user add. Dash m creates your, when the user's created, also creates a directory under slash home for that user. That's real easy to overlook. I think it's dash d if you wanted to, d. Well, you can do, you know, if for some reason you want to create that home directory a different name than the username, there's a way to do it. But dash m assumes, you know, whatever the username is, that's what you want to call your user folder under slash home. And just the dash capital G is followed by all the group names. That says put this user into these groups. Okay, so at this point I've SSH'd into it, into the Mycroft, create a new user that is equivalent to pi, the default pi user. There's also another user you go walk around directories, you look in slash home, there's also a Mycroft user, all lowercase. Now, the Mycroft user is what's doing all the personal assistant type stuff, the voice commands, all that. So, at this point, I've left out I didn't leave it out of the show notes, but I didn't put it in a lot of detail. At this point, I got curious. Well, there's HDMI port on the back, and I plug a monitor and a mouse and a keyboard into it. And, I found documentation you can. And I plugged in a monitor and didn't get anything, didn't get a picture. And I thought, oh, well, maybe it's because I'm not using a powered HDMI to VGA adapter. You know, I'm not using a new screen. I'm using, you know, old ones. Anytime I go to a thrift store or whatever, I look around for old hardware that I can use. So I've got a closet, really, 7 or 8, like 15-inch, 14-inch LCD monitors that people have upgraded and have got for, I think the most I'll ever pay for one like that is $5. So because I've got all these little mini board computers and I don't want to put big monitors on them, but some, you know, a lot of times, yeah, I just want something to make them usable. And well, I thought, you know, one or two things, either my adapter isn't working or they've got that turned off by default. And I started looking and sure enough, the Mycroft user didn't have nearly, using that ID command, didn't have nearly the access to that. Well, it didn't have the video group or anything like that. And I thought, well, that's why. But it turns out, no, when you're plugged into that, you're by default logged in as Pi, not as Mycroft. So I looked at, you know, and like I said, this is one of the troubles I have with their documentation. It's sort of like you just got to Google around and trip over stuff. So I found the thing that says, no, you know, that ought to be, HDMI port ought to be working out of the box. It's not like it's disabled or anything. So come to find out, I guess there were 3 series of these leaving the factory, and most of the ones in third series, they did something that HDMI was disabled. So I found out, yeah, you should be seeing something on that monitor. So, and was said was, well, yeah, this is a bug that's been fixed. All you need to do is sudo apt-get upgrade, sudo apt-get update. It actually did take a while. Like I said, they've got, I think, an 8 gig SD card in the Mycroft. About 7 of that is dedicated to root. So yeah, there's room in there to do your updates. Maybe install some other software if you wanted. So I did that, and magically went. You know, I did over SSH. Went, had it reboot. Went there in the bedroom, looked at the screen, yep, and I was logged in as Pi. Wasn't any challenge on the login. So, okay. Let's see. Yeah, okay. And then I went with the instructions for installing GUI on the Pycroft. I know. Why would I want that? On the Mycroft, the same instructions work. These instructions linked in the show notes are for a Pycroft, the one that you would build yourself. And really, let me look at those. I'm not going to go through those because it's install this, install that. Sake of disclosure, I originally thought it would be just as easy to install LXDE, and I figured that would bring X Windows. I guess not. In any case, Start X didn't work. In fact, it's from the command line. In fact, it still doesn't. But the very last thing is get into the Raspbian config. That incursus program that comes on Raspbian, and you can go in on the boot and change boot options. You know, you have GUI without a challenge, GUI with a challenge. In other words, you got to put in a password. With a challenge, as you put in a password. Command line, the same thing. So, you know, I wasn't too happy with it just coming up, not asking for a password. And, you know, when I have it boot into the GUI, then I can select my user. Well, I guess I could, if I had the challenge, I could select my user either way. But even so, like I said, StartX still doesn't seem to work to launch into the GUI. I may look at that a little more, then put it back to defaulting to command line and only jumping into the GUI when I tell it to. But following those instructions to install Pixel, which, if you're not aware, that's the interface that's pretty much just used by Raspbian. It's supposed to be a very, very light GUI interface. And files for LXD are still on there. I guess I could go in and purge it, but I got just room for everything to live there. It does not give me an option to switch desktops as most desktop managers do. But other than that, fully functional desktop. Don't have all the big storage hogs like OpenOffice or anything like that. But I do, you know, I do have sound. I have, I guess I haven't checked, actually. Rather than trying to throw it to HDMI, though that's possible. I'd hate to have to set up a set of speakers just for sound on the desktop, but I don't know. Like I said, I'm not sure what to do in the GUI, do with the GUI anyway. It would be, there's nothing that I can see that, you know, you could control the GUI with voice commands. I mean, I'm certain that's something that could be developed. You know, they're always looking for people to develop stuff for them. That could be an additional skill. But you do have a browser and, you know, some of the more fundamental things installed with that GUI desktop. Like I said, got a link to the documentation for that, and you just cut and paste commands in. So I am not going to sit down here and just read a list of all the packages that need to be installed. But, you know, it's essentially a process of sudo apt-get install package, and I don't know why they didn't do them all at once, but that's the way the author did it. And eventually get towards the end and then go into Raspbian config and select how you want it to boot up, at least on the connected monitor. So, okay. Then I thought, well, first, I'm going to let up on the mic, see if anybody has any questions so far. Sorry.
Just a real quick one, and I'm not sure if you're going to touch on that next or whether you had already touched on it and I missed it. But why did you want to hook up a monitor to it? Just because you could, or did you have something in mind that you wanted to do with it?
Really, just because I could. I mean, yeah, if eventually either somebody writes it or, you know, I might look and start writing Python scripts. I, you know, not that I know much about Python, but, you know, it might be cool if you could do a voice command when you're groggy and rolling out of bed and saying, "Hey, Mycroft, put this YouTube video up on the screen, or go to this news broadcast on the internet or whatever." But of course, since I've got a TV in the room, it'd be a lot easier to do that with the phone or something like that and throw it up on the TV where I can see it, rather than a 15-inch monitor. But mainly it was just because I could do it.
Have you tried anything at all where you can interact with the Mycroft and have it interact with it visually at all?
Well, see, I've had it do the news, and on the list of the default, I've got links there to the skills. And, it's like other things I had. I had the Chumby, which is kind of a similar thing 10 years ago, and it was, it was, well, maybe it wasn't 10 years ago, not quite. It was a little ARM computer. You could SSH into it, but essentially it was an alarm clock and had a screen, and you could watch various stuff on it. A lot of it is, it seemed like, instead of today's news, it was done a one-time thing. And it also was heavily dependent on the community writing stuff. And I guess everybody's writing to scratch their own itch, and nobody's writing to scratch mine, is one of the things that I look at on both the included skills and the user created ones.
So the original Mycroft come with the Mark 1 together. That come with any sort of, I know it didn't have a digital display, and I'd want to say the new one has some sort of a digital display on it, but does the older one have any sort of like pixelated display or anything like that? Like, could you use it as like an alarm clock, or, well, as a clock for that matter, along with the other two ghosts along and whatever?
Yeah, I didn't see anything display a clock. That's probably be a good addition. Definitely, it would be possible. It's got an LCD, but it's not a video LCD. It is, it is like sort of a text matrix LCD, and that was one of the things.
Marquee it's got a type LCD.
Exactly. Thank you, Netminer. And suppose we got stuff like an eye on either side, these two round circles, and then the middle. If it's talking to you, it'll make a mouth in there or something. Or if it's giving, some simple information, like I said, like the IP address, it'll scroll left and right. But there's no video as such. It'll be like a little 3-inch screen, I think, on the new one, on the Mark II. So that you, I think mainly because they want to do video telephone calls like the others. Well, I don't know. I guess they haven't talked about that. But it's more like, if you ask what's the temperature outside, it'll both say it and put it on the screen. So now I can use it as an alarm. I can say, just like you can go for an Android or any other phone now and say, set alarm for, whenever. Or you can do that with Google Home, whatever. So it'll do that. But I'll have to look again. I did not see anything to say, okay, make this my clock and have it display the time all the time.
You may want to look into VLC 3.0. If you can, it has interfaces to Chromecast, and that means that a lot of stuff can be streamed uh, can be streamed to any Chromecast instead of the video screen on whatever device you're running the VLC on.
Well, thanks. I hadn't realized that. I knew you could stream from. Well, I guess there's been a way to stream from a phone, various places, but I don't think it's quite just directly into the. You could stream from one computer to the other, but I don't recall there being an interface for the Chromecast before. I'll have to go around and update all my VLCs then. Thank you.
And also, it supports the, Dash standard, whatever it is, the streaming standard used by YouTube.
Right. I mean, and like I said, probably not the best computer for it, but if you did have storage, you could probably install, I'm blanking on the name of software because I don't use it, but, the one that streams movie files across the network.
Plex.
Thank you. Thank you. Exactly. Might not be quite powerful enough for it. I don't know.
Well, actually, a lot of VLC is supposed to be client-server, although very few people implement that side of it. If you could make the VLC on your Pi purely the interface device, and an intermediate from some other more powerful, server on your or desktop on your system, on your network, it would probably work pretty good.
All right. Let's see.
It's the video LAN stuff that most people don't really implement.
Well, thanks. I'll have to look into that. Okay. Last thing on the Mycroft Mark I. Like I said, one of the reasons getting SSH into it is so I could install additional skills. Use that with the Mycroft Skill Manager, which is in there by default, and it's MSM space install space name of skill, and you get those from the two links that I have just following that, the GitHub link, and there's a mycroft.ai/documentation/skills. The second one, it's just a list of name of skills. It doesn't really go into that much detail about what they do. Though they are linked to that page, where I have name of skill in that MSM install line, pretty much everything that is a link on there, if you just copy that, that's the name of the skill, and you do that MSM install space name of skill, and if you got the name right, you will see it, it'll report that it's installing something. I'd see documentation says, oh yeah, there's fuzzy, it's fuzzy logic, you just got to have close to the name, and so I was putting in a bunch of them and assuming they were going in because I wasn't getting any errors back. But no, if you don't see anything, and sometimes, if it thinks it's a syntax error, it'll give you an error. But if it doesn't do anything, then it didn't install anything. I mean, if you don't see any feedback on the command line. So it'll, it'll say it's getting the cloning repository and, unpacking and all that. Now, the problem I'm having, I also have that link says configure skills. And I should say, as far as I get, when you, I'd actually done this before, created an account with Mycroft. The Mycroft, since it had been unplugged for months, it wanted to be set set up again. So I actually had to recover my password with Mycroft.ai. Didn't look like any way to reconfigure it, so I had to remove it as a device, then go back in with the new code it was giving me, and add it back in again. But you configure the skills through the Mycroft.ai site on the web. And this is where I've got a problem, because I know there's two or three I put on there, and one of them's a podcast thing, and I guess you can put in up, I don't know why it's limited, I have to look at the code, but up to three podcasts, and I guess you would go on the configuration page and put in the RSS feed for, and then you know if one of them was RSS for Linux Slugcast, I could say, you know, Mycroft, play the last Linux Slugcast, and it would play it. Or if I had tilts in there, I could say the last Linux Link Tech Show. So, but when I go to configuration page, it says you don't have any skills, so you can't configure anything. Or at least no skills that require configuration. So I don't know. That's something I'm going to have to probably, I thought, give it a day and see if it took a while to find them or something. But in any case, I'll take that up with their tech support if I can't get it figured out. And like I said, I don't know why the one. There are several in there for specific podcasts. There's one in there for everything on Jupiter Broadcasting. You know, very similar, that you could. You know, you could say play the last such and such a show. So that might be, you know, kind of interesting. I'm not sure, I'd sit around my bedroom, listen to it. I mean, I'm sort of mobile when I listen to stuff. I'm using the player. But I've said before, that is kind of the thing I would like for my home assistants, and we're just not there yet on any of them. I want to go in and say, you know, Mycroft or Google or whoever, you know, play the next or the last episode, you know, of Defenders on my living room TV, and it would go in, check, verify, yes, I had a Netflix account, and do that and put it up without me having to sit down, you know, click on stuff. Or if I said play the last Flash, it would say, well, do you have Hulu? Yep, he's got Hulu. Well, no, Flash is CW. No, sorry. Play the last Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Yep, he's got Hulu. He can do that. Whatever. We're not, you know, I think that's the way we're heading with all these. For them to be successful, I think they're going to have to do stuff like that. But it's just somebody's going to have to build this whole omnibus interface to everything. And I bet in 3 years we'll have that. But we don't have it yet. So for podcasts, you know, I'm usually not even in the house when I listen to podcasts. So, you know, so be neat to tell Mycroft, yeah, play this podcast. But in the end, it's not going, you know, it's probably not the way that I'm going to consume that type of media. For visual media, that is certainly the different. Okay, any questions?
I could see it not just play, but if it was set up right, I could see being able to give it verbal commands to get various podcasts.
Oh yeah, exactly. You know, or at least a verbal interface in your podcatcher. I mean, Netflix is set up now, so most of the content on there you can actually download. My connection is usually good enough, and I'm not I haven't taken anything on the road. Maybe next thing, I might load my phone up or whatever computer I'm taking with me with content the next time I go someplace. But I say, man, if you're sitting in, nope, if you're spending money to go someplace, I mean, it's one thing if you're a road warrior and your job takes you someplace, but if it's your vacation, you're sitting in a hotel room watching Netflix, you're doing it wrong somehow.
Well, my brother does a lot of he's over the road, and I could see something like this really helpful. He's a trucker, and being able to yell at a box sitting, on the dashboard saying, "Get me whatever," where he doesn't have to have a full computer set up.
Does he use a lot of like 3G, 4G type things with for his computing while he's on the road?
Yes, he does. And but I'm just saying that being able to have something grabbed in the background so when he pulls over, he's got it local, might be helpful.
Yeah, I think that'd be awful hard on your on your 4G and other, other mobile download spec. And I don't know if you, I assume, I guess you could keep the connection while moving, but I don't know. I would think that'd be, and I don't know if truck stops like broadcast Wi-Fi outside. You might be able to park close enough to the Walmart to jump on their Wi-Fi or, well,
Yeah,
you
well,
know.
he does a lot of Wi-Fi stuff, but yeah, that might be helpful. But I would think that again, if you're using 4G, 3G, you'd probably want to stay to the audio only channels.
See, that's what I was thinking too, is that if if you had the ability to just turn down the volume and then, spout something off, like he was saying, like 50 was saying before about, play the next tilts or whatever, and then just have it automatically come up. Because I've noticed at times it's just a freaking pain to try to change what podcast I'm listening to while driving.
Yeah, I agree. I think probably we're going to see more. I mean, I know some people have worked on integrating Mycroft into vehicles. There's stuff on their website about it. Unfortunately, a lot of then again, you still need a constant internet connection for Mycroft to work. I do think I mentioned on a previous show they were scheduled to move from Google's voice to text interpretation to Mozilla's in next month. But when I did the update, there was a whole bunch of looked like Mozilla voice stuff coming down. So I don't know, maybe they already are on Mozilla. But again, I guess text, even with that's probably not such a huge thing that it's gonna chew up your bandwidth like streaming video would.
And stepping back a bit, I may really look into x86 Pixel myself for a number of applications. Both low old 32-bit systems, and as a utility system, maybe a second boot on a lot of stuff, so that when I just want to get up, or if I need to fix something, or run, you know, partitioning stuff off of a USB drive or what have you, it seems like a good utility system.
Well, or you've got a bunch of older computers, you know, Pixel probably has one of the lightest footprints out there, as I understand it.
Also, I'm thinking where my systems have always been set up to be VM hosts and whatnot. That's how come I've stuffed them with memory. In fact, is one of the things that I'm going to try on the old 64-bitter is it's now 2 gig because that's the official maximum. I'm going to try to get 2 gig SIMs and see if I can upgrade it to 4 gigs, which would make it a much, you know, give me a little more elbow room in the memory side.
Okay, I think I've covered everything I did with the Mycroft pretty well. The other project I took on this week, I've never been that, I mean, yeah, I like the idea of home automation. In practicality, it's usually easier for me to flip the switch than it is to, turn the lights on or turn the lights off. And, well, especially since just built the new house, expensive LED bulbs everywhere, which keeps my expenses, you know, my power expenses down. But I'm not really that eager right now to replace all these bulbs. They're supposed to last 10, 20 years with smart bulbs just to have home automation. And really everything else.
I think the wall switches would probably be cheaper. You can get them that are Echo enabled. I don't know about Mycroft enabled, but that seems like a decent alternative.
Yeah, and that's one thing. I believe if somebody were to write the code, there is some home automation stuff built into the Mycroft, but it's not anything that's tying into the like the Google universe or anything. And I think that's one thing. They're all for it all to work. They're going to have to tie into each other's universes you know, what you get is sort of ubiquitous is not the right word, but sort of transparent, which one you get. I think we'll eventually get to that point. But, so you're just not buying. Well, you know, of course, everybody likes fit. All these companies like vendor buy-ins, so maybe not. But, there's not much around here that I would, you know, say would benefit me that much to have voice command over. Yeah, you could do voice command on the thermostat. I don't change it that often. I've got a light switch in the bedroom over my bed, so I don't have to, you know, so I don't have to stumble around in the dark. So that's not a problem. That was one thing we did think about. And you're right, Joe, probably, you know, building them into the switches. I don't know. Usually I come in a room and I walk past the switch, and it's a lot easier to flip that switch than to, you know, talk into the air and tell it to switch. But since this place is so well lit, I don't really have that many separate lamps. But I do have some... you know, sort of for atmosphere. I've wanted one of these for a while, so Couple weeks ago, on eBay, I ordered myself a pufferfish lamp, and this sort of you usually find these. Oh, you'll find them around in home decor stores, but they're mostly tied into the tiki type home decor stuff. So what it is actually a skinned pufferfish, and if you don't know, that's the one with all the spines that when a bigger it's threatened by a predator, it somehow is able to puff itself up to about five times its original size to scare it away. So I'm thinking probably what they do is they take the skin and they stretch it over a balloon, for it to dry out or whatever, and then they pop the balloon, and then there's a hole in it, and they just put a little low power lamp. The one I have, it's an LED and it's constantly shifting colors, for the whole spectrum of the rainbow. So that's pretty cool. Thing is, I think it's meant to go over like a desk or something because the switch is in the cord and right there next to the lamp itself, not on the wall end of the cord. And it's a short cord anyway, so where I've got it, I've got it plugged into an extension cord. So any place on the cord where there was a switch, it'd be out of reach. And besides, the whole thing is in the corner behind my TV. I've got a big TV in the corner of the living room, and the fish is actually above it and slightly back. So it's an area I'm not gonna want to run around there and turn the thing on and off. I don't want to leave it on all the time. So, it occurred to me, oh, okay, here is a great place to incorporate home automation. So looked around on Amazon, and I may regret it, but I bought like the cheapest wall plug home automation stuff I could get. It plugs in between the cord and the plug on the wall, just a little thing about half an inch wide and inch or so in diameter. Just it goes into $26 for a set of two. And they said says on the website compatible with both Echo and Google Home. Got worried when I looked at the documentation because the documentation doesn't mention Google Home anywhere. But no, you download the app from the App Store, and that's a little confusing. Because it says in the documentation, look for Smart Home, and that's not the name on the on Amazon. I'm not sure. There's a name there. I'm not sure that even is the company name or something descriptive. But you're looking for the Smart Home app, and in particular, no, Smart Life, and in particular, Smart Life dash Smart Living, because there is another Smart Life app, and before installing that, I didn't read through the reviews, and the reviews said, yeah, this is a fake app that doesn't work, and he's just trying to get your Wi-Fi password. So I don't know if that's true or not. Maybe a guy just didn't like the app that came with this brand and decided to write his own and tie into an API. I don't know, but I got the one that's just on my phone. That doesn't work. I needed the. It wasn't the one shown in documentation. Smart Life, Smart Living. You set up an account with them. I get tired of all these things. To use something that you've bought, you've got to create an account with the manufacturer. And it's like, well, it's all working here in the house. Why do I need that? But actually, since it ties into Google, yeah, it uses your username and password that you create to verify the account. So I can see that. Now, one of the problems is, in the living room, what I use is my Android device rather than getting my phone out, to consume media. I use Android apps on my Chromebook and then throw them over. If it's streaming media, I throw it over on the Chromecast, of course. So I was disappointed. The Smart Life app, the good one, is not compatible for some reason with my Chromebook. But I only need to get the voice working. I only needed it on one Android device. So I got it on my phone. Once you get it on your phone and you register your account and then you set up the device, you know, you tie it in and name it, you know, so you've got a push button on the app, you know, turn the switch on, turn the switch off. Okay. You're good so far, but if you've got Google Home or Echo, well, either one you can tie in. You know, like I said, Mycroft not so much yet. But if you want to tie it into your Google Home, and this would also include, you know, your speech to text stuff that's on the phone, so you could talk into the phone rather than using the app if you didn't have a Google Home. But you go to the Google Home app on the phone and you can find the documentation online. I forget, but it's a little fiddly. It's more fiddly than I think it should have to be. But yeah, you can go. Well, there's a list of devices. Why? Yeah, if you go in, there's a list. There is a home automation section, and then you go by company, and then you can scroll down. You know, find the Smart Life. In my case, and then at that point you put in the username and password that you created on the Smart Life website, or through the Smart Life app, and it goes, looks, finds the wall plug, and you know, basically it goes by whatever you called the wall plug. So were I to say, "Hey Google, turn Puffy on,"
you got it. Turning on the Puffy.
See, that was the Google Home on my desk. So, it's remotely turned on this lamp in my living room. So, you know, other than lamps, I don't know what electronic, I was trying to get that earlier, didn't, what electronic device do we have in our home that we want just to straight turn on and off? I can't think of anything that,
well, I can't think of anything. I have mine set up with a power strip, and it's connected to two lamps and an electric blanket.
Oh, yeah, I can see how the electric blanket might be handy, so you wouldn't, you know, you just have it on all the time, you know, and turn on when you need it. Though, you know, my experience with electric blanket is those things pull an awful lot of juice, so I'd probably want to get a high-end, you know, unit to make sure it didn't burn something up.
Right.
And I was thinking, going through all this, you know, if I ever wanted to go further into home automation, you know, would I regret buying these cheapy things rather than going into something that was a more integrated system, so that everything home automation would be for one company, and I wouldn't have to have this app and that app and this other app, you know, to get them all to work. But these things were not so expensive that, you know, if I were to, you know, invest greater in home automation, then that would be, would just replacing them wouldn't be that much of a hardship. Yeah, you know, and I could see things like, I don't have drapes or blinds. If I had drapes or blinds, and under different circumstances I would have, I won't go into that. But, you know, if I did have those, then yeah, definitely I would, it would be handy to have those automated. But like I said, light switches, I'm, you know, if I want a light switch on, I'm usually walking right past it anyway.
Coffee maker?
Oh, could be though. Most decent coffee makers, probably have a timer built in. If you, I mean, if you,
Go ahead.
I mean, I would think if you wanted your coffee maker to start to come on 10 minutes before you got up or whatever, I'm sure you can buy coffee makers that have that function built in that I would probably trust more.
True, but there's people, not myself, but there are other people who don't necessarily get up at the exact same time every day, so they can just kind of get up, or when they start to wake up, tell their home automation to start the coffee machine. So by the time they make it up or make it to the coffee machine, it'd already be done. Plus, you have situations where, like, maybe you have a dinner party, so you have the coffee maker already set up and ready to go. And so once once everybody is done eating and talking and stuff like that, you can just tell the coffee maker to start, and so the coffee will be ready for dessert, you know.
Yeah,
And
I could.
you also have appliances that draw electricity even when they're turned off. So a switch like that could be helpful there.
Well, right, because definitely TVs and which, for all practical purpose, a modern LCD or flat screen TV, it is a computer inside. Even a dumb TV. Well, a lot of stuff, microwaves, it's cheaper to use an already done logic circuit and write software for it than it is to, design something that says you are going to be a microwave. Or, to write chips that they're just gonna, that's all they're gonna be used for. But, so there's really, I can see the coffee maker, were it I, and if it was, depending on how much it would cost, I would have more faith into, a coffee maker that had, on the box integrates into Echo or integrates into Google Home. So you'd have Wi-Fi or yeah, probably Wi-Fi. They're not going to put an Ethernet port on a coffee maker, but so instead of physically turning the coffee maker on and off, you would it would be on your network. Of course, a lot of people's probably say, no, we don't want devices that we can't see into and we can't update floating around on our network. So just I'm not sure something pulls power. Well, I don't know what a coffee maker pulls. I'm not sure if I would. Again, I would probably want a higher end smart plug than what I'm using.
I want to mention that pluggable.com has a Bluetooth smart plug capability for your coffee maker or what have you.
Okay, yeah, where you control it with a phone app.
Oh, yeah, well, with whatever Bluetooth driver you want to do. You do the whole Bluetooth pairing off on stuff. I haven't used it, but it is out there. And I think Bluetooth would be far more likely for a coffee maker or something than Wi-Fi.
Depending on the range of that Bluetooth.
Well, most of the time you can. I mean, 10 meters would cover most, a lot of houses.
Yeah, I get your point then. So in other words, you would have some sort of Bluetooth controller tied into your Google Home, or plugged in, into your network, and from there it would jump to the coffee maker.
Right, your good job for a Raspberry Pi or what have you. In fact, is I could see a Raspberry Pi used as a hub for whatever home automation solutions there are. That would make more sense for home automation is to have a dedicated control router.
Like
so your home automation solution says turn on device 75.22.23, and then the Pi goes through and says, all right, this one's controlled by Wi-Fi, this one's controlled by Bluetooth, this one's controlled by a hardwire.
I do believe there is software to do that already. Like, there's one called Home Automation Assistant, and I believe there's another one called Node-RED. I believe that's there. I mean, let me take a look. I want to say that's what Flying Rich has been talking about for the last several weeks, isn't it? Is Home Automated Assistant, which he has running on a Raspberry Pi.
Yeah, I need to go back and look at those. But that would probably illuminate a lot of that. And, you know, the whole Bluetooth thing solves the problem of here you have this essentially a computer or at least a host on your network that you can't look into, you know, running around on your network. So if you make that last jump Bluetooth, then all you have to do is trust your home automation software and the hardware that it's running on.
Also, if you have problems with Bluetooth, getting a long USB cable and putting your putting an additional Bluetooth dongle out there is a fairly cheap solution. You could even tuck it up into the ceiling on your kitchen or wherever.
Yeah, and I bet where I have networking run everywhere, I could adapt the Ethernet wires for, you know, Bluetooth, change the plug on either end. And on the end that's back where my router is and stuff, no, you would not have that plugged into the network. You do it, well, just like I do my phones, you know, my antique phones around the house. RJ11 jack plugs into, you know, an RJ45 wall plug, and that just puts all the phones on the same line, which is not to say that on the other end that they're plugged into the network, or at least not until they go through the voice over IP box. But I'm just using the existing wires that were run through the walls when the house was built.
Yeah, but hanging a Pi of some kind as your local unit on the network and just tucking your wires up under the kitchen cabinets or what have you for whatever antenna.
Well, and, right, for that matter, I'm sure you could have multiple Pis, just just use them for the Bluetooth termination.
And then your controller would say, all right, I need to talk to Pi 2732 and tell it turn on whatever.
Oh yeah, there is, well, we have the capability to live like the Jetsons now, you know, almost. And I'm certain, again, 10, 20 years, it'll be so commonplace, somebody will go in, oh yeah, you got one of those old homes that don't have all that stuff.
Hey, one of my prized possessions is a hardwired ringer telephone. Pretty soon, not having Ethernet in the walls rather than through the walls. My arrangement, you'd think that there had been some crazy woodpeckers in the house. It's going to be just like having the old ringer telephone.
Well, like I said, I collect ringer telephones, as I mentioned. I need to do some more detail on that. And just to throw it out there, somebody, I assume some sort of telemarketer, the only way they could be doing this, if they'd got my name from, say, if you have Facebook on your phone and somebody's put their phone number in Facebook, it sucks all those into your contacts. And this has got to be an automated system, because today, about 4 o'clock or five, I had both my cell phone and all the wall phones, which were tied through voice over IP to my Google Voice number, ring at the same time, and not ring long enough for me to reach them. So it's an automated system. If somebody picks up, then it's dialing several phones at once, and when somebody picks up, it drops the rest of them. But this is the second time in 3 days that's happened, and the only way that could be is somebody is going through a telephone listing they've picked up through Android or whatever it has. In other words, probably both my numbers are, I've got both numbers next to each other in my Android phone book, both of them for me, and some automated system through Facebook, through Google or whatever has picked up on that, and I'm in somebody's database now, and the two numbers right next to each other, so they both ring at the same time. I am not happy.
Yeah, I get line calls about electricity on an unlisted number. And, this is a public service announcement. Rah, rah, rah. Your electric bill is going to triple if you don't pick up and let us confirm we've got a human on this line.
Yes, there is no problem with your credit card, but you have a limited time to take advantage of our offer or whatever. Or, your warranty is about to run out on your car. I'm sorry. Everything that I own is from the last century. I don't think they're under warranty anymore.
I can top that one. Somebody wanted to get my mother to have her extend her auto warranty. Now, my mother has several problems with that. One, she never had a driver's license. Two, she never had a car. And three, she's dead.
Well, and I got, I got the landline disconnected more because procrastinated on paying the bill rather than not wanting to have a landline. But I mean, last couple of years that I had a landline, nobody ever called me that I wanted to talk to. I mean, never anybody that I knew.
Well, since my internet comes through the landline, I'm sort of stuck with it.
And doing things out of order here, because I really think I'm going to want Honky maybe to do his project, and we'll come back to the links. I do have two, you know, most of the links I have, I don't really think bear a lot of the discussion this week. I just thought I would throw them in there in the show notes so where people would find them. So we're talking about phone service, internet service. Charter Cable, I guess, which is, if you follow the link, it shows the states. I'm not sure they're in every city in those states. It seems, I think it's confined just to a few metropolitan areas. But if you do happen to be, you know, get your cable through Charter Cable, which I've heard of before, they're not a big company, but they're around. You will have an option for gigabit internet, I think, by the end of the month. And you won't be forced to gigabit internet, but you'll have the option for $100 a month to get gigabit internet. So if you're on Charter, I'm jealous.
Now, it's a cable company, so can you get actual just internet, or do you have to get your cable, phone, and everything else, and then you get it for $100 a month or whatever?
I hadn't thought of that. Let me open, see if the article says.
If you want just internet, it's $200.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think they were talking about that. Was it... Tilsis last week, they were kind of talking about that because everybody's wanting to cut, you know. You get HBO, Showtime, and Cinemax over the internet now. And of course, you've got Hulu and all that stuff. Is there any point of getting cable anymore?
I guess for some live events type of thing, but I guess there are other ways to get around that as well.
Well, that's true.
Better
yeah,
package
people,
deals, probably.
People watch a bunch of sports, but shoot, you know, I'm getting HBO over the internet cheaper than I was getting it when I had cable. Well, I won't say that because they package it real well when I briefly had cable, but. You know, after that first year, whatever is out, yeah, I'd be paying twice for HBO what I do now.
Heck, I think the Super Bowl was on Amazon, wasn't it?
I think there were a couple of streaming services available for it.
Besides regular, when it comes to football, besides regular, just regular Sunday, 1 o'clock, 4 o'clock, you could probably pick up the games either on. There was a couple of services that were running it, and I think Twitter was one of them. They were running like Monday Night Football or something.
I guess it's 8 markets that Charter is in, so it's maybe not every place. It says Oahu, Austin, San Antonio, Charlotte, Cincinnati, KC, Missouri, New York City, and Raleigh-Durham.
Comcast has a nice firm monopoly around here.
Yeah, Comcast is pretty much it, although I guess in Boston you can get some RCN.
I'm looking at it, doesn't say anything other than internet, so I'm guessing the regular cable stuff or phone or whatever would be on top of the 125. Still, Well, let's see. Google Fiber is $70 with that, you know. But if you're in a place that gigabit was just not available and all of a sudden it was, yeah, I think I would jump on that. I mean, I am paying literally half of that for 3 gigabit down. Or not gigabit, gigabyte, or not gigabyte, megabyte, 3 meg down. Megabits, 3 megabits down.
Ouch.
If I was more committed to, video streaming and stuff, I would probably jump to something like that if I could afford it.
Well, really, what I've got most days, I can stream video without any buffering. Occasionally, it's once in a while, and about once a day, I usually have to go and toggle power on the uplink. And I keep telling them, well, and they came out and said, no, it's your router. No, I said it's your uplink because I've had different routers and it's the same thing. But they charged me $30 for the house call and said, you don't have any problem. But oh well.
You were wondering about your home automation? That's a perfect example of a good place to put it.
Oh yeah, I've been thinking. I mean, that was what the second plug was going to be for, but it's I was looking for a function where I could, I mean, you can put timer on it. You can say, turn it on this time of day, turn it off this time of day, but you can't say, turn it off for 60 seconds, then turn it back on, which is what I was looking for. Believe me, I had that in mind. Well, I do have a plug. I got Walmart that's not as good, but I can again, not compatible with the Chromebook. So, but I do have an app on my phone. Instead of walking back in there, I can turn it on and off again over the Wi-Fi. Now, obviously, voice control on that, you can see that minor the problem there.
Well, I'm not talking necessarily voice control, but I'm talking about having something that sounds like something for a cron job.
Oh, I see what you mean. Have it reset once a day, whether I need it or not. No, my
What?
schedule it.
Not necessarily once a day, once a week.
Well, once a week wouldn't get it, but and like I said, it always seems to fix the problem once I reset, or most of the time it fixes it once I reset the uplink. Every once in a while, I've got to do both it and the router to get, before it stops glitching. But eventually, I can get it. But what I was looking for a thing, I could do a voice command. Hey, Google, reset uplink. And of course,
Sorry, I can't help with that yet.
yeah. Thank you, Google. If I could put it on timer and say if I gave it that command and it would turn it off for 60 seconds, then bring it back up automatically, that would work. But if I say, turn off uplink, and then I try to say turn on uplink, since Google Voice, or I mean not Google Voice, the Google Home requires an internet connection, that's not going to do me any good. I can kill it, but I'd still physically have to walk back in there to bring it back up. So yeah, I was definitely looking at that as a candidate for home automation. If anybody out there knows of a smart plug device that I can configure, you know, for, you know, kill it for this set amount of time, then bring it back, let me know.
Well, you got the wrong command there.
Oh?
Yes, the command that you want, which would work through the Google system, is reset uplink.
Well, yeah, but the plugs that I have don't have that function. I can't. I could set specific times during the day to turn them on and off, but I can't say, you know, turn it off for a minute, then bring it back.
Well, I'm just saying, it's not the voice command side that's the problem. Because if you could send the reset uplink, it would do the reset uplink, then the device that's handling the reset would be doing the switch on and off.
Yeah, but the device I have doesn't. I can tell it to turn something on. I can tell it to turn something off. I can tell it turn something off at 1 a.m. or and turn it back on at 2 a.m. But I can't tell it, you know, from the time I issue this command, turn it off for 60 seconds, then bring it back.
Right. What if
you automate the command in between?
Right.
Like a little command file that says turn it off, turn it on.
Right. That's what I was going to say. Is Home Assistant or Home Assistant combined with Node-RED, or I think there's other programs like If Then Then That, where you can program that on the little the Home Assistant server. That might do it.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah. Okay, I'll have to look into that.
Scripting saves the world again.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking about, you know, issuing the command to a management device, and then it would issue the command to the smart plug. That's good. Thank you.
Oh, on notes from other technical areas, my I had an uncle who was working for Comset, and what they have developed, and this was some years ago, so they're probably even more sophisticated now, is they were having problems with different countries not liking us having ground stations in their country. So they got around it by putting up relay satellites. The satellite would go over a U.S. territory ground station, get a bunch of commands for other satellites, and then when it went into orbit near one of those satellites, it would beam the orders to it. So it was a satellite management satellite.
That's cool.
Yep.
Hockey.
I've been to Goddard, and I really wish that I'd called Australia or something when I was able to do that back in the dawn of time.
We had the question on the Charter cable. Looks like that $100 to $125 is internet only. So I think I said that. Okay. Tell you what, Honky, why don't you tell us about fixing your Arch Linux laptop, and then I'll get to my links. Like I said earlier, most of the links that I have don't bear a whole lot of discussion, but they're things probably I think people ought to know about.
Sure. Sorry if my lips are flashing. I'm trying to do. I have a hard time sometimes with this stupid button, so I'm trying to get my double push talk to work right. Hey, there it is. All right. So if anyone remembers back, I had, let's see, the life of this laptop. I have put on Arch Linux on it by using a program called Architect Linux, and what it is basically just a ncurses interface that like builds a bunch of scripts, I guess, to basically automate the installation of an Arch system, of just a bare bones Arch system. I had used that on this laptop probably about a year ago, and then back about, I want to say it was November, that Arch said that they're just giving up on 32-bit systems. So my whole system went, you know, was basically defunct. So looking around, I found a distro, a fork of Arch called Arch Linux 32, which is they're keeping up with they're having the 32-bit systems. They're keeping up with like the back end of the 32-bit systems and recompiling everything for 32-bit. And so I had changed all the repos and got that running on the system. You know, everything was running fine at first. I reset the laptop, and all of a sudden I would boot into the like the whole boot screen would come on and go through its list of everything that it's doing, and then it would load up. But the problem is I could only see maybe about an inch at the bottom of the screen, and everything was still the boot screen. It would not clear the boot screen from the screen. So I had been fighting with this. I think the biggest problem I had was trying to figure out exactly how to describe the problem. Because when you go out onto the intertubes and you start searching, you start trying to find what to, you know, try to solve your problems, you have to give it the right wording to you know, find what exactly it is you're looking for. So I had spent a good amount of time trying to figure out what my problem was exactly, how to fix my problem. If anyone has ever seen a problem like that before. I've done anything between the one big thing I did try before this was trying to put other desktop managers on. And the one thing I did find to work for a while is I had LightDM installed, and I when I initially set the laptop up, I had LightDM installed, and then I put GDM on. So one of the things that I found was with GDM, if I had just hit the power button and put it to sleep, and then woke it back up, I can log back in, and I would get I'd have the full screen back again. Everything went clear, which was a very frustrating temporary fix. And I was at a point where I was gonna probably nuke and pave this thing, and possibly either grab another Debian system, because I'm finding that with everybody going away from 32-bit, one person who never seems to is good old Debian, or retry Architect Linux, and then just go into, like, it gives you a section where you can edit which repos you go in, you're going to be using. So whether I can just go in, use Architect, change the repos to the Arch Linux 32, and whatever other caveats it might ask for or need, and then just be able to use that to go to completely rebuild a system from scratch the same way I originally did, but using the Arch Linux 32 repos. But before I did that, I decided I was going to give it one last shot and just try to dig down and try to figure out what the problem was. So I finally kind of figured that it had something to do with clearing the screen, the boot screen. So after I kind of got the wording down, I was able to find some stuff here and there, and it turns out it was a grub issue. So what I had to do was edit the /etc/deepfault/grub file, just change the line. It's one of the first lines on it. The grub underscore command line cmd line underscore Linux underscore default equals quiet, and then just add to it VGA equals current, and then rechange grub. So when you make changes to the /etc/default/grub file, you need to have it reconfigure grub, and then it'll change the /boot/grub/grub. That's dash. Sorry, fighting the cold. /boot/grub/grub.cfg file. So to do that, you do grub-mkconfig --o and then /boot/grub/grub.cfg. And then I tried that and it worked. I got this thing working. We started, well, I got on the line about 8:45. It was probably about like 8:30, 8:25 that I got this thing finally working. So I am super happy that I don't have to nuke and pave this thing, because I kind of like, I like Arch Linux. And I like the way that the, having Arch on this, having the, this is a tiny little laptop with like, it's like a 10-inch screen. It's, it's my only laptop that has an SSD drive on it. It takes like 2 minutes to boot up. Not 2 minutes. It's like less than a minute to go from boot to desktop. I mean, it's quick, it's fast, it's nice, and I don't have to kill it now. So that's fantastic, and I got it working.
Well, that's so satisfying when you get into something and it's esoteric, and then, you know, it's not something everybody's had to deal with, and then all of a sudden, you find that thing that you're looking for to make it work, and you try it and it works.
Yeah, and like I said, the hardest part I think was just trying to get the proper wording of what the problem was to be able to search for an answer.
Yeah, that's what always gets me, is it's, you know, what do I need to look at? And you try this and you try that, and eventually you come up with the one person that's had the problem before and documented it.
Right. It's actually in like the Arch Wiki. It just says quiet VGA. It doesn't give much of a description as to what the problem was. But I was at a point right now where I was trying just about anything. Just throw it at it. I mean, what's the worst? I was about ready to nuke and pave. So, I mean, what's the worst that could happen? I actually have to do what I was going to do. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep, so that's okay. That's all I got. I rescued my laptop.
Well, that's always good. It's always satisfying to, you know, wrest something from the jaws of destruction. Okay, like I said, I'll pause between each of these. I'm not sure if they all bear a lot of discussion, but I think there's stuff the audience would be interested in. SUSE Studio shut down as of, I think, today. It says 15th. And what SUSE Studio was you could sort of roll your own SUSE-based distribution. You could, you know, take this package out, add this package in, then download the ISO and burn it. Where probably this is most useful in, say, business environments where you want everybody to be run the same software. You don't want to have to do the install, then go and do an apt-get, or in the case of SUSE Zyper, you know, this list of packages that you want everybody in the office to use. So A lot of people used it, liked it. It's being moved to something called Open Build Service, which is also hosted by SUSE. So I really don't know what the difference is unless they're just consolidating their operations. I knew about this because I do have a system running SUSE, so that I'm on the mailing list somewhere. Came in an email. It was just a reminder that it was going to be gone after SUSE Studio is going to be gone after the 15th. And they said, yeah, earlier emails we sent you links to where you can migrate, anything that you had in SUSE Studio over to Open Build Service. So it seems like probably they've got a 100% equivalent service out there. It's just letting people know if they go back and look for SUSE Studio and it's gone, that there's something out there, something else out there that they can use. Okay, last month, I mentioned that I had seen a link. I thought it was in Google Plus, but I hadn't saved it for a European hosting service that was even cheaper than DigitalOcean's Droplet. And that is Scaleway.com. Their cheapest service, which looks to be, at least as good as DigitalOcean's Droplet service. And this is minimal stuff. It's not going to be for a whole lot of people who are hitting your website. It's mainly for personal type stuff. The first thing I'm going to throw on is Quassel Server, of course. But their cheapest service lists for 2.99 euros a month. And I looked, current exchange rate, euro is $1.25. So for us, that's $3.75 a month. And like I said, it compares favorably with the DigitalOcean Droplet. So I'm probably going to go with that, throw my, at least my Quassel server over on that, so I can straighten out my IRC. And then after that, I may look, see if that's enough bandwidth to run stuff like Mattermost or I just had it, and I closed the page. Next cloud. One say open cloud, that isn't right. Well, it is, but you're gonna go setting up a new one. Definitely go with next cloud. All those kinds of servers. That way, I would have access to it without punching a hole through my firewall. Of course, some people think, well, you probably don't want to put anything out there floating around on the net on somebody else's server. So I might consider what I'm actually putting out there. But for most stuff, everybody else puts it out there on a cloud server. So probably no reason I can't. Okay, this was really discussed pretty well. I was listening to it this afternoon in the latest episode of Late Night Linux, which I highly recommend you listening to. But it's KDE Plasma Mobile for your Android phone. Essentially giving an Android a KDE-like desktop. Apparently there's not a whole lot of apps out there. It's very, very early days. So they've put it out there mainly to have people, asking people to be alpha testers. And they said this is not stable. If you look at the webpage, they're pretty much recommending you not put this on production. But if you got an old tablet, or in my case, I've got a couple old phones here, I could put it on. Maybe throw it on there and help them bug test. It's not something that's probably going to help you productivity at this time. But putting it on something and testing it out may, and giving them your feedback may accelerate the development process. And what they were talking about on Late Night Linux, apparently there is supposed to be there's an attempt to create a completely open phone, and they have a couple user interfaces for it, and one of them is going to be KDE Plasma Mobile. So, getting rid of all the binary blobs, having a completely open device. Well, of course, the phone part is going to have to be closed because it is. But as far as the computer part,
is that the Libre?
Something like that, yeah. Interesting. I've got a link to instructable articles about a guy building a Pi-based Nintendo Switch clone. It's slightly smaller, but looks just like a Nintendo Switch. At least the mobile part of it, the controllers look the same. And there's a parts list. And of course, there's the 3D printer files, and also linked, where you can get those printed if you don't have a 3D printer. And of course, it's not going to run in any way Switch software. I mean, it's not like you're going to take this and put Breath of the Wild on it, but you can run RetroPie. So it's essentially a mobile RetroPie platform, has a 7-inch LCD.
I think I read somewhere that somebody also got Linux installed on the Switch.
Oh, I hadn't realized that. I'll have to look that up because I do have a Switch. But even if building your own gaming, or at least this particular gaming device, is not of interest to you, it shows you where on the bottom side of the Pi where you can solder in audio connectors and the switch and the game controller switches and all that kind of stuff. I'm not sure why they didn't just plug into the external ports, except probably they could make the case a lot more compact, if you don't have stuff sticking out the ends. But I think for a lot of hobbyists, this would be of interest, even if this particular project is not your cup of tea. This next one really is not Linux related necessarily. It's a great headline. Apparently some Russian nuclear scientists were using a top secret supercomputer to mine Bitcoin. Not going to go in detail on that one because I didn't really read the article that much. It's just a great headline. We talked about the Charter Cable offering gigabit internet. Link to a Pi-sized Intel board, unlike the one Rich has. I should have looked it up before show. This does not include memory or CPU. It's an empty CPU slot and a couple DDR4 slots. So once you buy this board, you're not done. It's 5 inches on a side, or a little less than 5 inches, so probably twice the size of Raspberry Pi on that order. Maybe not quite twice the size. But, you know, and it's one of those deals that they do not list the price on the website. you have to call them. So they're, you know, they're looking towards corporate type, customers probably, you know, not really meant as a hobbyist board. But you know, if you want a really powerful, small form factor board, if that's what you need, that may be a place to look.
We were actually talking about this board, before the show started.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. Well, I wasn't here, so I wouldn't.
Yeah, this thing's a beast.
Yeah, but I think, well, something Dor said when they were discussing it, you know, it's probably one of those deals, if you have to ask, you can't afford it.
That's probably true.
And I'll have to bring DistroWatch up to date. They're usually better than this. I mentioned last time that I'd seen a link to a new, or that said there was a version out this fall of Makulu Linux, which we were just talking about a few weeks ago. And then when I actually looked for it on DistroWatch, it, you know, it said last release was 2015. Well, I was looking before the show to download it. Still on DistroWatch, it says last release 2015. But there, you know, if you just search Google, I was able to find a Makulu Linux page that, you know, shows a December 2017 release, which I downloaded because I want to play. I'm either going to play with a virtual machine, or I've got a couple laptops here that I do want to nuke and pave. So I might try it on one of them. Because it's been a while since I played with the Aero desktop. It looks like some interesting things there, and I think you really have to do Makulu to get it. So I assume there's nothing strange going on, because I, you know, months ago I talked about seeing Makulu, and I don't remember what the website was then, but the look and feel of the website was completely different from the one I found last night. So, you know, they could have just revised the website or whatever, or I don't know if different people were in charge or something and have forked it or what, or at least taken it over or what the story is. But I figured the very least I can do is spin off an email to DistroWatch people and tell them, hey, if you looked here, because I think you don't think you're up to date.
Yeah. Also, one of the things that they are a little weird about is that they have actually four different distributions, but they feature the two custom distros primarily.
Well, I saw two the other day when I looked at it. It looked like one was a couple months newer than the other. I didn't, but there was definitely a difference in naming convention. So I didn't realize there was any difference other than the release date.
They have Flash, Leth, Lindows, and
so are they aiming at different types of users then, or is there one that's like a minimal release and one that's like a big one?
Well, the Shift release is Cinnamon and is optimized for being their very lightweight distro.
Okay, that's right. I did see four, including the Cinnamon, and since I can get Cinnamon on anything, I was looking at the two that were Aero. But you're right. They less is say additional
is a dock based. I don't know the detail about that one.
Because right now, the page I have linked, I see Shift and I see Lindo's. I guess the difference, one, Shift is Debian-based and Lindo's is Ubuntu.
Less, I guess, is macOS-like. In the way the applications are launched and whatnot. They call it dock based. One I'm interested in is their Flash.
Oh, I see. Yeah, you can Flash and Leather at the top of the and Lindo's and Shift, but the download screen just shows Shift and Lindo's.
Yeah, Flash is high-performance XFCE Debian.
Yeah, Debian testing and it's rolling. Well, if it's Debian testing, it would be.
Yeah, and it says it's supposed to be as easy to use as Ubuntu, but more performance.
Yeah, I've never really found Debian particularly hard to use. What they may mean is, Debian usually doesn't support least proprietary documents out of the box, so that could be one thing. Where to say easy use, you don't have to go in and install a whole bunch of codecs.
Yeah, codecs and stuff that may be considered marginally open source because it's not, you know, whatever, drivers, etc. What Debian would call restricted.
Yeah, that might make a good show sometime. Is maybe throw them all, each on a virtual machine and do a shootout between them.
Yep, especially if you could configure it so that your VMs are similar.
Well, gentlemen, that was my last link. Does anybody have anything else they'd like to bring up?
Nope, I'm out.
Well, seeing not, I would like to thank Joe for joining us this evening. I thought we were going to have somebody else on there for a minute, but they just popped their head in and popped back out. Let's hope they decide to join us on a more regular basis if it's their inclination. Our next recording date will be the 2nd of March. Our intro and outro music is Downright, provided by Claude2 and Brome. We'd like to thank Tony Bemis from the Sunday Morning Linux Review for our web hosting, WordPress support, and email list server. And we'd like to thank Delwyn providing the Mumble server we use, and creating a bot module to find the next show recording date. To do that, you just type .ns in the IRC command line in the hash Linux Lugcast channel on Freenode. We can be reached at feedback@linuxlugcast.com. We have a G+ community linked in the show notes. I'm not going to read that whole long number out. And we also have a mailing list. There's a link in the show notes. And as I said, we use Freenode as our IRC server. And we found out on the channel hash Linux Lugcast. I'd like to thank everything for being here this evening. Honky Magoo.
Good night, all.
Joe.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Oh, anytime. Just drop in whenever you have the time. And thank you, Netminer.
You're welcome, folks. Take care, and I'll see you in March.
SMLR 2.0 is the revamped Sunday Morning Linux Review with Tony Bemis, Mary Tomich, and Tom Lawrence. On even episodes, we cover distro fever and tech news. On the odd episodes will be fresh looks where we review a distro or software or tips and tricks. Live recordings are bi-weekly. Sunday morning on both Google Hangouts on air and audio only stream. Visit smlr.us for all the shows and the live recording schedule.
Oh my God, it's Hacker Public Radio! Hacker Public Radio is a daily podcast by the hacker community for the hacker community. If you're interested in technology, creative thinking, hacking, Linux, or any kind of computer, that kind of stuff, you should listen to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.com.
The Linux Link Tech Show. Tune in to the world's longest-running Linux podcast live every Wednesday, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Find us on the web at www.twlts.org or email us at techshow@thelinuxlink.net. IRC server, thelinuxlink.net /techshow. Join Pat, Alan, Link, and Joel. And don't forget the two Dans. They are so hot. I know, because I've kissed them both. And Flying Rich, he's a bloody drunko.
If you don't like a gas, you can get up your ass. Ain't no funny duddies, that'll get back.